As health care legislation emerges from the last of the House and Senate committees this week, the White House is soliciting support from some unlikely allies, Republicans. In recent days, such high-profile Republicans as California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist have come out in support of reform. The administration hopes this will help win over moderates in Congress. NPR's Andrea Seabrook has more.
The former majority leader of the Senate, Republican Bill Frist, said that if he were in Congress now, he'd take the heat and vote for health care reform. Here he is on CNN.
I'm coming out very strongly in support of what's going on in the Senate Finance Committee. It's bipartisan. I hope that it ends up being bipartisan, so we're on the way there.
Then there's Mark McClellan. He ran Medicare under President George W. Bush.
Congress needs to act. The health care issues facing this country are both major and urgent. We have a real opportunity now to make some progress. My hope is that we'll take advantage of those opportunities.
And here's another one, Republican Bob Dole, another former Senate Majority Leader.
I think we need health care reform, and we need it now. We don't need it 4 or 5 years from now.
Dole spoke to NPR's political editor Ken Rudin a few weeks ago, and his stance has only gotten stronger since, that the Republican minority in Congress needs to be more flexible. He told the Kansas City Star, quote, "I don't want the Republicans putting up a no sign and saying we're not open for business." And there are more Republicans coming out, some after being nudged by the Obama administration. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, former Tennessee Senator Howard Baker, another past majority leader, and Bush administration Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson. He signed on to a joint statement with former House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt that says, "Failure to reach an agreement on health reform this year is not an acceptable option." So, is all this pressure from Republicans outside Congress affecting Republicans inside Congress?
Not a bit. Not a bit.
No, exactly the opposite.
No.
That's the answer from California's Daryl Issa, Illinois' Mark Kirk, and Arizona's Jeff Flake.
It's like endorsements in a congressional race. They're usually overrated.
Flake says what's going on here is an obvious political tactic by the Obama administration.
They'll always go after people to try to get support, and we expect that, but I can't see it affecting many votes here.
And many congressional Republicans point out, if you look closely at all those endorsements, they're actually pretty vague. Frist, for example, is urging Congress to pass a bill after some changes are made. And California's Daryl Issa says Schwarzenegger's support isn't unconditional either.
My governor's not saying sign H.R. 3200 or vote for it, and nothing close to it.
H.R. 3200 being the number of the bill expected to come before the House. But Issa does acknowledge the main message of all those Republicans outside the Capitol, that there is a big opportunity here that should not be wasted.
Yes, they do want us to reach a compromise on those things which we can compromise on, which would lower the cost of health care and increase availability and portability. And Republicans, almost to a person, are very much in favor of that, including myself.
The problem is all that other stuff, the health care reforms the majority Democrats want to enact. So whether rank-and-file Republicans ultimately vote yay or nay, as Bob Dole says, it's probably going to be the toughest vote they'll cast in their congressional career. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
When artist Robert Fontenot heard the Los Angeles County Museum was auctioning off part of its costume and textile collection earlier this year, he grabbed his coat and his wallet. Since then, armed with scissors, some thread, and a needle, Fontenot is breaking down the items he bought and finding new ways to use them. Reporter Vanessa Romo walked through his studio as he talked about his collection.
Artist Robert Fontenot had no idea what he was about to buy. He only knew two things. One, it was up for auction by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art as part of their costume and textile collection. And two, no one else seemed to want it.
So there were all these lots that were going by, and I was like, oh my God, I could have bought that. That was so, like, some that didn't sell and some that went really cheaply. And like, so no one bid on one lot. I was like, I don't even know what that is. I'll take that.
So for just $20, Fontenot became the proud owner of The Mystery Lot.
And it ended up being the John Anthony coat.
He designed dresses for Jackie Kennedy Onassis.
A Galanos coat.
That's James Galanos, whose most famous client is Nancy Reagan. And there was a Claire McCardle.
The Claire McCardle dress.
Fontenot took his bargain buy back to his house in Inglewood, California, where he lives with his partner. The neighborhood is not exactly a hotbed of modern art, but then Fontenot doesn't like running in those circles anyway. Born and raised in what he calls a very southern way in Mobile, Alabama, he studied photography at the Rhode Island School of Design. But over the years, he's moved more towards sculpture and textile design. After more than two decades as an artist, he's had several gallery shows in New York and L.A.
This is my studio. It's not usually quite this cluttered.
The auction purchase may have seemed impulsive, but it was part of a larger plan. Fontenot's working on a new series he's calling Recycle LACMA. LACMA, as in Los Angeles County Museum of Art. In all, he's acquired a little more than 50 pieces from LACMA's costume and textile collection, and he's painstakingly deconstructing every garment to create something new.
Part of the idea was, all right, LACMA had these items. Some of them weren't in good shape, some of them... obviously, they had better examples of. They weren't going to use them. Well, in my mind, it's sort of like a ship. You don't want to just throw something over when it's useless if there's another way it can be used.
He takes each piece, pieces once carefully collected and cataloged by the museum, and he gives them a second life as useful art, or what he calls practical sculptures.
You know, partially, it's getting over the assumption that you can't make something. We're trained to think that things are difficult to make. And a lot of things aren't.
So, a pair of corduroy 1920s knickerbockers becomes a pair of plush boxing gloves, and a silk brocade dress transforms into an umbrella.
In my mind, it's the sort of thing that the woman who wore the gown could have also had the umbrella with her in some horribly matchy-matchy world.
And remember the Galanos coat? That became a car seat cover.
There was just something about that big floral pattern and all the black fabric that really reminded me of... well, of those cheap car seat covers you can buy, usually big Hawaiian prints, that I could make just a really sort of nice, wonderful version of that.
Fontenot is chronicling every step of this project on his blog, where he also addresses the contentious issue of deaccessioning. That's a fancy word museums use when they sell or unload unwanted pieces.
I've learned that there is a widespread misconception that because something was in a museum, it's museum quality, which... as you can see from some of these items, is just not true.
He certainly isn't the first artist to shine a spotlight on a museum's leftover collection. In 1970, Andy Warhol's Raiding the Icebox exhibit displayed a museum's collection of chairs. But Rita Gonzalez, curator of contemporary art for LACMA, says Fontenot's work goes beyond that. Speaking from Europe, where she's on a courier trip for the museum, she says there's a poetic aspect to his work.
This idea of recycling and how to think of artists, the work of the artist ultimately as a job of recycling, recycling culture, recycling metaphors, recycling history. So that I think is the most poignant thing about his project.
For Fontenot, the entire life cycle of art, from its initial inspiration to the creation to the acquisition of it, even to its disposal, is very Zen, very Lion King, very circle of life. And captivated as he is by the theme of recycling, there's really only one place he'd like to see his final collection.
I long ago had to give up the idea that I could control what happened to my pieces, but the dream owner of everything would be LACMA again.
For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Romo.
And a note, if you're on Facebook, friend us at facebook.com/NPR Weekend, all one word. You'll find a discussion board to share your story ideas for the show, and you can see videos of the staff behind the scenes, senior producer Ned Wharton getting on a camel on assignment in Egypt, and other fun stuff we decided to recycle online. That's facebook.com/NPR Weekend.
Just across the bay from San Francisco, in Berkeley, lives Michael Chabon.
He's a writer who's been called the John Updike of his generation. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and his other books, like The Yiddish Policeman's Union, have won critical acclaim. A couple of years ago, Details magazine asked Chabon to write essays about his life as a dad, the mundane things about raising kids, like changing diapers and buying groceries, setting up playdates, in short, what he calls the intimacy of domestic tasks. And the result is a book of 39 essays. It's called Manhood for Amateurs. Michael Chabon is here with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks, Guy. It's very good to be here.
So I have a problem with the book.
Oh, great. I can't wait.
And the problem is I wish that you could just read from every essay, but then we'd run out of time.
Good. I was going for my checkbook to give you a refund.
Okay. But seriously, even though these essays are nonfiction, they feel really familiar to people who have read your work. Did you sort of sweat over the prose and the language in the same way you would when writing fiction?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't really have a choice in the matter. When I'm working on a sentence, there's kind of nothing else for me in the world at that moment but that sentence that I'm working on, and I get just as tied up in knots over that sentence, whether I'm writing even, you know, an email to my kid's teacher at school. I get really, I just can't just write and sort of freely toss things off.
At the start of this book, you have a line, and it reads, "The handy thing about being a father is that the historic standard is so pitifully low." And I want to ask you if you could read another part of that essay. It's called William and I, and it's on page 17.
Sure, I'd be happy to. My dad did what was expected of him, but like most men of the time, he didn't do very much apart from the traditional weaning of bread. He didn't take me to get my hair cut or my teeth cleaned. He didn't make the appointments. He didn't shop for my clothes. He didn't make my breakfast, lunch, or dinner. My mother did all of those things, and nobody ever told her when she did them that it made her a good mother.
Michael Chabon, you argue that the dads have it pretty easy.
I mean, I think it's hard being a father, and it's always been hard being a father, but I think it's this that the societal standard for what constitutes being a good father is pathetically low. And men are praised much more frequently, much more readily for doing much less than women, who almost never receive that kind of... people just don't go up to women in the grocery store while they're
and say, you're a good
around.
Mom.
You're such a good mom. I can tell. I mean, you'd be a freak for saying that. people say that to me all the time, and it's when I'm not doing anything that I would particularly like to be given credit for. It's just for being there.
My mother lived with us for a couple months after my wife went back to work, when our baby was born. And there was a point where I started to change my son's diaper, and my mom sort of intervened and said, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Almost as if I wasn't supposed to do it.
Right.
But when I read this book, it made me realize that it's not actually about changing the diaper. It's about the intimacy of those domestic tasks, that bond that that dads want to have with their kids.
Yes. I mean, that's the... in a way, the mysterious thing about it, because it's not really fun. It's not fun to change diapers. It's not fun to clean up vomit. It's not fun to, you know, I'm choosing the more disgusting task, but just, you know, taking on a task-by-task basis, who wouldn't rather have someone else do them? But somehow, you know, the payoff often comes in those moments when your child turns to you, you know, when there's somebody there that needs you the way that a small child needs his or her parent. And, you know, if that parent is you, I think for a lot of couples, it's mom. It's always mommy. And mommy's the one who's turned to when something is really urgently needed. And that is such a wonderful experience. I would never want it to have missed out on that by virtue of the fact that I got out of all those icky jobs.
In one of the essays in the book, you write about a moment when your daughter asks you about drug use, and your son's in the room too, and she's learning about it at school, and you admit that you had used marijuana in the past, and she asks how many times.
Yeah, it was my son actually asked me.
Right.
We were ready, in a sense. My wife and I had spoken many times about this famous or infamous conversation that all contemporary parents dread and hopefully
sex and drugs.
Prepare for. Yeah, sex. You know, sex... not so much. I mean, I think it's kind of clear what you're going to say. With drugs, there's so much hypocrisy involved. You know, so much of parenting involves hypocrisy. In fact, being a parent means almost by definition that you're a hypocrite because you're trying to teach your children always to be better people than you are yourself. So we had agreed to be honest. We were going to tell the truth. You know, we weren't going to say drugs are bad and if you smoke marijuana, you'll become a heroin addict. And we decided we would teach them that, you know, you need it had to be done responsibly, that it was very much illegal and that you could get in terrible trouble for doing it. And yet somehow when this subject came up, I was just completely, you know, caught by surprise. It came out of nowhere. We were talking about Beatles lyrics. Next thing I know, they're asking me how many times I've smoked marijuana. And you know, the truthful answer at that point was 1 million. But I did not want to say that. You know, all my resolve to be honest and truthful, you know, was I was staring it in the face. And so I said a number of times, which was not a lie. Fair enough. Seemed to satisfy him for the moment. And I should say, I felt like I steered the conversation ultimately to the best possible place I could hope for. I was honest with you. I will always be honest with you. And I just hope that you guys will be honest with me and you'll share with me whatever you're going through because you know I just told you the truth.
Somehow you are incredibly prolific. You seem to crank out books that readers and critics love, which is quite an achievement. I've seen you refer to discipline, not talent. You say that discipline is your strength.
Well, absolutely. You must have talent. One must be talented and one must also be lucky. And I have been very lucky, but there's one aspect that isn't under my control that I can do something about, and it's discipline. It's getting my butt in the chair every day, trying to get 1,000 words a day, even in the worst, darkest periods of my life.
So in a way, is fatherhood a little bit like being a writer?
You know, I guess in a way there is a discipline. It is a discipline in that you have to do it, and you have to do it every day.
No matter how you feel.
No matter how you feel.
You have to get out of bed.
And there's a kind of minimum standard that you have to meet. There's no page count, but like, you can't just, you know, stick a bag of Cheetos in your kid's backpack and send them off to school. You actually have to make a lunch, and it should have a protein. And, you know, there is a praxis there. There's, like, sort of a daily minimum set of things that you just absolutely need to do or it won't work. And I mean, there's satisfaction to be derived, just as there is in writing. When I get my 1,000 words, I have that incredible sense of well-being. And let's say I have the foresight to make my kids' lunches the night before so that I make all the lunches and they're all packed and in the refrigerator and they're ready to go and I don't have to do that tomorrow morning. And I know that I have a similar sense of having done my work that is gratifying.
Michael Chabon is the author of several books, including his new one, a collection of essays called Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. Michael Chabon, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Guy. I had a great time.
And our last word in business today is fish out of water and on the road. If you've ever looked at a school of fish, you may have noticed how quickly and how closely individual fish can swim together without bumping into each other. Researchers at Nissan have been studying this. Last week at a technology show outside Tokyo, the car maker unveiled a group of little robots that mimic fish using high-tech wizardry that could end up in future vehicles.
The robots are embedded with technologies that allow them to see and sense how others are moving around them. Nissan says the goal is to create crash-free cars and contribute to a, quote, environmentally friendly and traffic jam-free driving environment. But don't expect to see crash-free cars on the road anytime soon. It may take some time to perfect the technology. You know, bear in mind the differences here. A fish in a school of fish is rarely distracted by an iPhone or a rambunctious child. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The November issue will be Gourmet Magazine's last. Ad revenue has dropped nearly 43%, and publisher Condé Nast has pulled the plug. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf finds reactions are mixed.
There is as much shock as chagrin. Gourmet Magazine has always been there. Well, at least for 68 years. It is the iconic food chronicle, the first of its kind, an institution. Along with Julia Child, Gourmet introduced Americans to a new world of food. Now, that world has changed. I did an unscientific survey on Gourmet's demise. Reactions varied from, I could care less, to, I'm in mourning. Some call it elitist, while others say it's the only food magazine that hasn't been dumbed down. Some love the literate prose, others want more recipes, less writing. Editor Ruth Reichel is praised and damned. But, like the magazine, people know her name. The World Wide Web did the magazine no favors. Why invite more clutter when you can go online to Epicurious, a gourmet partner, and get the same recipes for free? But Gourmet is more than recipes. It approaches food as culture. It inspired generations of cooks to reach beyond the known. My friend Peggy in Denver fantasizes about going to that little cafe in Montreal or the B&B on the coast of Maine. Joanne emailed, I have traveled to Chile, remote Chinese villages, and hidden corners of New York City thanks to Gourmet articles. And people hang on to them. My friend Jennifer has every copy since 1977. The November issue is especially prized for holiday planning. Every year before Thanksgiving, Jennifer hauls out all 32 of her November gourmets. Today's food magazines reflect a world of different tastes. Worried about fat? Get Cooking Light. On a budget? Every Day with Rachel Ray. It's also generational. My friends are of a certain age. Our children, in their 20s, cook differently, if they cook at all. With some happy exceptions, they don't use a magazine like Gourmet for dinner party inspiration. And they live in a digital world. My 28-year-old son says Gourmet, as well as most print publications, has no relevance to his generation. Even the word gourmet is old-fashioned, replaced by the infelicitous term foodie. Blogs, recipe sites, and food TV will inspire the next generation of cooks. But for those who see the death of gourmet as the loss of an old friend, there will be one last November issue. Hang on to it.
Bonnie Wolf is the author of Talking with My Mouthful and editor of NPR's Kitchen Window. Stimulus money released to the states last April by the U.S. Department of Education was supposed to be used to boost funding for schools and colleges, as well as protect key programs and jobs. Well, now comes word from the department's inspector general that some states slashed education budgets anyway and are using stimulus dollars to replace the money they cut. NPR's Claudio Sanchez explains.
The Obama administration's message to states from the get-go was this: stimulus funds earmarked for education are to supplement, not supplant, state funding for schools and colleges. Here's what Education Secretary Arne Duncan had to say in late summer.
We're really focused on making sure states are using the stimulus money well. But what we want to do is make sure that people aren't playing games.
It wasn't long, though, before the Education Department started hearing about states playing what it called shell games with stimulus funds. In at least one case, department officials blocked a state from drawing stimulus money because it was cutting school funding so deeply. This growing dispute with states has become so politically charged, the Education Department declined to comment for this story. The department's inspector general, on the other hand, hasn't been shy at all. In its report about how states were spending stimulus funds, it found that over a dozen states are inappropriately using stimulus dollars to replace the money they've cut from education. It specifically cited Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut.
We're really perplexed at a report and need to sort it out.
That's Thomas Murphy, spokesman for Connecticut's Department of Education. He says his state got high marks this summer when federal education officials looked at its proposal for spending stimulus funds.
These funds came with the greatest flexibility to help states stabilize their education funding programs, and that's how Connecticut used those funds.
Murphy says Connecticut is in compliance as long as it doesn't cut education spending below 2006 levels. But it's clear that lots of states won't be able to maintain that level of funding, let alone boost spending on education, as the Obama administration would like.
25 states have cut funding for K-12 education, and 34 have cut higher education funding.
John Shore is with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. He says the stimulus aid has covered no more than 30% of states' budget shortfalls.
State states are facing such a severe crisis that a lot of the federal money is helping states just to stay even and to avoid further budget cuts.
Minnesota, for example, is balancing its budget by delaying almost $2 billion in payments to schools. Michigan plans to cut per-student funding by $218. Missouri has frozen funding for its public colleges indefinitely. Linda Libring is Missouri's budget director.
We have to make do with the money we have. And given that our revenues are doing much worse than anticipated, we will have to make additional reductions in the budget to keep it in line with available revenue.
Education, says Libring, will be the last thing Missouri cuts. U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan warns if states cut education below 2006 levels and use stimulus funds to plug holes in their education budgets, he may exclude them from billions of dollars the administration is offering states for reforming their schools. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.